This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. And joining us to discuss the top stories of the week, WVXU reporter Ann Thompson, WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, and Inquirer reporter Jason Williams. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. You can join us by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Lisa, Jason, and Ann, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah.
And let's start by talking about the Otto Warm Beer. He was released from a North Korean prison this week, and that was after, what, 18 months of imprisonment? Is that right?
That's right. Okay. So this came as quite a surprise, at least to me. I'd been checking on this, but the government had kept this kind of quiet. So some months ago, I tried to do an update, and really the community had too, and the parents were told, as Mr. Warmbier said in his news conference, just to, you know, not upset the North Koreans and just to keep quiet. And so nobody was really talking about this. And then Tuesday, we got word that he was released and then came back and flew into Lunken Airport.
Yeah. Do we have any idea how this came about? Has anybody said how his release was obtained?
Well, on 1A this morning, I heard some of the details. So there was a representative to North Korea, or Yun. And maybe, Jason, you know more about this than me. But he was given direction from the Trump administration to go over there and try to get him out. Mm-hmm. And they had been hearing that maybe he wasn't well, or there was something about the Swedish or Swiss person was going to go check on them. And they, I think, heard that maybe he wasn't doing well and they wanted to get him out. So that's kind of how it transpired.
And I'd say it was Joseph Yun, too, I believe is who it was. So what condition is he in, Ann?
Well, he's in a coma, and yesterday the doctors described him as in a state of unresponsive wakefulness. So he's not really aware of his
surroundings. Is that the same as a coma?
Well, maybe like vegetative state. I don't know if that was the old term.
But they're calling it unresponsive wakefulness.
His eyes kind of just, you know, spontaneously open and close, but he's not really aware of his surroundings, and he's not really understanding anything that's being said. Was that your impression, Jason?
And his arms and legs. I mean, the muscle tone, he's like, it was all pretty much all gone in his appendages. And, but yeah, they said he does not respond to like verbal command or verbal people talking to him, but he does. I guess the wakefulness means, I understood, is that that's the blinking part.
Okay.
Is that he's blinking, so that apparently is the wakefulness of the unresponsive wakefulness terminology.
If I understood the medical, UC's medical team yesterday, as they described sort of the extent of his brain injury, that they were led to believe that he had been in this vegetative state or this unresponsive wakefulness just a few weeks preceding his containment. Is that right? Did I hear that correctly?
So there were a couple of MRIs that were done in North Korea, and there was a disc that was sent with Otto Warmbier on the plane. And so doctors were just had concluded, kind of, excuse me, looking at that, that a few weeks prior to the one taken in April is when the damage occurred. And nobody knows exactly what happened. The doctors were kind of guessing because they said that he had a respiratory event. So there was a time where he was without oxygen, and that possibly this could have come from medication, like an overdose, either accidentally or on purpose. But nobody really knows. Or it could be something else.
But they're saying that he has suffered, what, extensive loss of brain tissue?
Exactly. That's the term that they used, extensive loss of tissue in all regions of the brain. And so, you know, people are wondering, well, how long would he stay like this? And what's his prognosis? But the doctors really weren't going to say that because they said the family didn't want that discussed.
Now, how is the family taking all this?
Well, obviously, they're very upset. I mean, here's their 22-year-old son who is just in this, as we said, unresponsive wakefulness state, and he can't understand anything. And Mr. Warmbier, during his news conference, was just very upset at North Korea and the whole regime. At one point, though, he said, you know, we're generally a positive family and we're happy and we're going to remain that way. So I guess they're trying to have a positive attitude, but it doesn't really look good for their son.
No, it was interesting. I the press conference was, Mr. Fred Warmbier was very, like, he was non-emotional. He literally delivered what, and you think, like, 2 days after your son gets home and this crazy ordeal, and it wasn't until right at the end of about a 15-20 minute press conference, his voice cracked. And so that was really interesting and impressive that he was able to stand up there in front of the world, essentially, and just deliver this. And he minced no words, of course, about North Korea and North Korea, I mean, calling them a terrorist state, and mentioned that he was, you know, he talked positively. He was like, he was proud of his son, that he was happy to have him home, that the family and friends could be around him. When he was asked about his son's condition, medical condition, all he said was, "We're trying to make him comfortable."
Exactly. And he was wearing the jacket that his son wore when he was sentenced. And that might have been when he also got emotional. He referenced it a couple of times. So he had on the exact jacket that we saw on TV when his son was being sentenced in North Korea. And that's what he was wearing. But you're right. He did hold it together. The mother wasn't there. She was said to be at her son's bedside. So it was just the dad and a couple of teachers at this news conference at Wyoming High School.
And up to this point, Ann, you were saying that the family's been staying pretty quiet.
They had been. Now, they found out a week earlier that their son was in a coma. They found this out.
So they just found it out recently then?
Before the rest of us did, but they knew a week prior. So when Otto landed at the airport on Tuesday night, so some friends and family had gathered there with signs, and one of them I talked to, he said he was at a wedding and the weekend before, and Fred Warmbier had told him that they knew this.
Yeah, how did Otto Warmbier, how did he fall into the custody of the North Koreans? How did all that happen?
So apparently he liked to travel, and this was a tour that was arranged by a company that would then fly from China to North Korea.
Yes.
And just as the dad explained, you know, he was a curious kid. You know, lots of people like to travel, and he had this opportunity, and he told his dad about it, and his mom and dad were very supportive, and they said, go ahead. I know we do think, like, North Korea isn't the safest place, but it was this tour, and the tour claimed that everything was fine and their son would be protected, and so he went ahead.
I heard the dad refer to Otto several times as, you know, thrill-seeking. And so you can just imagine sort of kind of the life and spirit that this young gentleman was leading up until then. His dad had a lot of admiration, and you could tell he was really proud of his son. And he used that term a lot, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very proud of Otto and the strength he's shown.
Yeah, and Tucker Carlson from Fox News sat down with Fred Warmbier in their home in Wyoming. I guess it was a couple nights ago, and it aired last night. And so Fred Warmbier took the camera crew up into what is Otto Warmbier's room, or was his room when he growing up in the house. And they had all the clothes that he had in his suitcase that he took to North Korea, and it was like some tie dye, very very free spirity types of T-shirts and. Like, you know, sort of like you were living this kind of beach laid back life, short, you know, cargo shorts, I believe. And I think Carlson said something like, yeah, he's along the lines of him being a free spirit. And his dad said that was Otto. I think he used the past tense, that was Otto. It was interesting because I think that Fred Warmbier was using a lot of past tense verbs in his talking about his son, which I thought was interesting and sad as well.
Yeah, very sad. Because as you were saying, Anne, the doctors really aren't saying much as to whether they think he'll recover or not from this.
No, it doesn't look too good. But yes, they just wouldn't go into that. And they were asked a couple of different times, but the family does not want that discussed.
Yeah.
He's not, as I understood it too, there are no machines keeping him alive. Is that correct? So he's breathing on his own, but he's just in this state of restful
unresponsive wakefulness.
And it's just really eye-opening to know that, you know, someone could live in that state for so long.
I mean, obviously, he at some point was in a somewhat worse condition, and his body is healed, and it's healed to this point. So you're right. He doesn't have any supplemental oxygen. He doesn't have a ventilator. He's just in this state, but it's just his brain.
And doctors are not sure how this happened?
Well, before the news conference, we were all thinking that he probably received some kind of blow to the head. Maybe he was
beaten. This was a traumatic head injury of some type. Okay.
But they said that they saw no evidence of this. And somebody else asked, well, what about torture and any kind of like soft tissue damage or anything? And there's nothing. So either, you know, it's healed or it was something subtle. If, in fact, he was tortured, nobody really knows. In fact, Mr. Warmbier said at the news conference that you probably have a lot of questions, and so do I. And unfortunately, we don't have very many answers.
And whether those answers, well, whether the family or any of us will ever get those answers is, I'm very skeptical of that, unfortunately.
On 1A today, one of the reporters was saying, you know, that she didn't expect this case to die. She expects that our government is going to press them for answers just because, you know, the other, you know, some other prisoners they've had have been returned. They might have been, you know, tortured, but they weren't in this kind of condition. So that our government
wasn't there.
Would press.
Wasn't there a second person from Southwest Ohio who was imprisoned in North Korea and recently came back home as well? I can't remember the name.
I think he left a Bible, right?
Is he Dayton area?
Yes, Dayton area. And so Mr. Warmbier was asked about that by a Dayton reporter who said, "Hey, you know, do you see any similarities between Otto and some of these other people?" And he just greatly distanced himself, which I thought was a little odd. No, there's, you know, no similarities. In fact, you know, Otto was never in any kind of trouble. Well, the Dayton guy really wasn't. I mean, he left a Bible, but. And then the reporter said, "Well, have you been in contact with this Dayton person?" And said, "You know, no. You know, they might have reached out to us, but you know, no, we're not really about that, or we're not interested in that." I thought that was a little odd.
Yeah,
I felt like you could really hear from the father yesterday his frustration, and that he felt like they did what they were asked to do, to hang back, let government officials do their job, and. You know, eventually the family said, "Enough. We need to take this matter into our own hands." And that I was a little surprised to hear sort of his level of frustration with that. So it's just a lot of insight into sort of just the anxiety that a family is going through. I can't imagine it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as Jason was saying, we may never know all the answers to what happened. And
right.
Yeah, it's a very, very sad situation. But we will continue our conversation. You can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon as we talk about the top stories of the week, WVXU reporter Ann Thompson, WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard Kuhn, and Inquirer reporter Jason Williams. Later in the show, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles will join us. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Lisa, WCPO.com has been covering the case of a local business owner who's accused by the federal government of importing fentanyl.
That's right.
Yeah. So tell us some more about this.
You know, this to me, and having covered the heroin epidemic and the opioid epidemic for several years now, just really exemplifies how rapidly this crisis is evolving. I mean, the fact that someone can go online and there's lots of mentions that folks are buying this on the dark web. I don't even think you have to be on the dark web to be able to purchase fentanyl. But in this case, it was her name's Grace Bosworth from Norwood. She was the founder of a local company called Global to Local Language Solutions. And the case alleges that she would go online. She and a partner involved in this, who is a Jim Halpin, they would go online. They would purchase fentanyl from sites in Canada. they would receive it through the mail, and then they would repackage it and ship it out. So she was also selling it. And she would charge $35 for next day delivery. It's just really a shocking case, but a big one in that I think it was found or alleged that she had shipped at least 30 to 35 parcels containing up to 100 milligrams of fentanyl, which is a large
quantity. A lot of fentanyl, because very small doses of this are very, very potent.
They're incredibly potent, as has been well documented and reported. Increasingly, overdoses are ratcheting up because fentanyl is being used to cut into heroin. We're finding fentanyl is being cut into cocaine and marijuana. Marijuana has been being laced with fentanyl now. And so it's just incredibly potent, and you don't need a lot to overdose.
Yeah. So this, she was going online. She and her partner in this were going online, allegedly, and purchasing this.
Yeah, yeah.
On the dark web, as they call it.
So the dark web is this, you know, shady, murky space in our world that exists sort of beyond your typical Google searches, right? You need some sophisticated equipment to access places on the dark web that have to do with coding, et cetera. And so allegedly she was operating her own storefront, so to speak, on the dark web where she would advertise fentanyl sales. And like I said, I mean, just it seemed like a direct-to-consumer marketing plan. If you need it now, $35, you'll have it the next day kind of thing.
And if I understand correctly, too, Lisa, police were saying that the amount that was seized was enough to kill a stadium full of people, basically.
Yeah, I mean, up to 100 milligrams. I can't recall off the top of my head sort of what a typical, you know, amount it would take for someone to overdose. But we're talking, you know, single digits of milligrams could be what somebody who is a regular fentanyl user is consuming in a day. So that's a large customer base if you're talking about 30 to 35 packages up to 100 milligrams.
So this is just starting into the federal court system then.
It is. It is. And it's going to be, you know, one to really watch because this is the kind of these are the kind of cases that I think law enforcement are really chasing after, right? So there's a long history in our country of sort of being able to follow the paths of cartels, et cetera, but really wrapping your arms around the kind of sophistication you need to follow what's happening when somebody can just walk up to their computer and order this online. So I think this will tell us a lot about the kinds of tools our law enforcement is using to figure out sort of this so-called business approach from, you know, this Norwood business owner decided she's going to supplement her income. She was also a regular fentanyl user, according to these documents, but she's supplementing her income by becoming basically online drug dealer.
Yeah. That's been one of the big questions, too, in the whole opioid crisis is where is it coming from? How is it making its way into our area? So that's why this is so important to keep an eye on this particular case.
So it's really eye-opening from that standpoint. You know, what we have heard from law enforcement and DEA officials is the common pathways for fentanyl or even the more powerful carfentanyl to make its way into the U.S. is it's created somewhere in a lab in China. Then it makes its way into Mexico and then moves its way through the U.S.
And if I understand, this was coming from Canada, is what they're saying.
Canada has intermittently been mentioned, I would say, in the last year. And so this case shows a direct connection to Canada. And what I find really interesting in covering this, when you look at just a map of the U.S. and you think about the states that have really been hit hard, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, that's just south of our northern border. And so it's quick, easy shipment coming across the border. And so there's possibly questions there about, should we be looking harder at our northern border in terms of how to control these substances from coming in? But it's also, questions related to just the U.S. mail I know Portman has put forward a bill called the STOP Act that proposes to make some changes, you know, to mail services, enhanced sort of surveillance of packages, because these things, in this case, fentanyl was showing up wrapped up in a magazine. That isn't quite as sophisticated as we might think the effort would be to deliver mail or deliver drugs through the mail. So there's a real question from leaders in Ohio and leaders across the U.S. about what kind of effort are we really putting in terms of tracking the flow of these drugs through the U.S. mail system.
What are public health officials saying, too, at this point? Are they seeing an increase in overdoses recently, Lisa?
It's been ebbing and flowing. So we'll reach a point where things seem to sort of level off. The new normal, so to speak, is 50 to 70 overdoses in a month. And then when a bad batch of this stuff, so to speak, enters, you know, we're up in the hundreds again. So I was just talking to Newtown Police Chief Tom Sinan this morning, and he was telling me, you know, on average, it's about 70, between that 50 and 70 mark, and just law enforcement feels completely overrun right now.
And when did fentanyl start showing up in marijuana? Maybe I'm just out of it. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah, so...
That's a pretty new development, isn't it?
It is. And so what law enforcement has been sharing with us and is that, you know, and this is happening elsewhere in the country, but we've certainly seen it in Ohio. Within the recent months, it was definitely showing up in cocaine, and we have had instances of overdoses from individuals who thought they were only purchasing cocaine, but yet it was laced with fentanyl. And then law enforcement will say, you know, they're putting it in marijuana too. So I don't know of a confirmed case, but that's what we're hearing from law enforcement, and I would trust that they have their hand on the pulse of this for sure.
Now, Ann, you've been covering the case of Evans Landscaping.
Yeah, speaking of federal court and
right, federal cases,
and indictment. Right. So Evans Landscaping been around a long time. Many people are familiar, especially on the east side. They're in Newtown, and so here is what the federal government alleges. Well, let me just tell you first their side of the story. Okay, so this is what Evan says. So Evan says they have a consultant, a computer consultant, and this guy, who was a minority, came to them wanting to start a business. And Evans, kind of out of the goodness of their heart, gives the guy about $85,000 and says, here you go, you know, have at it. And so this guy then gets some contracts with the city, $2 million worth of contracts for, you know, applied and got them, you know, for small business minority contracts. And then Evan says this guy ran into some trouble and they just had to step in. And they said there was nothing secretive about it. The city knew it was kind of Evan's and Evan's money and this guy. All right. But the feds say that Evan's illegally secured these contracts by establishing this front company. And it was really their company all along.
So they're accusing him of fraudulence.
Exactly. Okay. All right. So they committed fraud by illegally getting these contracts from the city and from the state. And this company's name was Ergon. And so they would go in and they would clear, demolish buildings, clear construction sites. And that's the kind of work that it was.
Where does this stand presently, and in the legal system?
So Doug Evans, the owner, right, and one of his managers, Jim Bailey, they were arraigned this week, and they both pleaded not guilty. They originally both had to surrender their passports, but then I guess Bailey had a trip overseas, and they let him retain his for a while.
Yeah. Have there been any other Evans employees?
So there were four who have pleaded guilty and then are supposedly cooperating. And one of them is the guy that we're talking about that started this Ergon company. And I don't have their names in front of me, but there were four people and they were all like employees or consultants with Evans.
Okay, so Evans' case is still ongoing.
And they face a lot of time. So these two face, I think it's like 20 years on each count. They could both, if convicted on all counts, get like 100 years in jail.
Okay. Jason, let's talk about FC Cincinnati. You've been doing some coverage on that. They have plans to – they're playing at Nippert right now, mm-hmm. UC's Nippert, but they want their own stadium. So they're working on plans for building their own facility. And you've been doing some coverage on that at the Inquirer. First off, What's the stadium going to look like? Have they released what their vision for this?
They have, and the club released design concepts from actually a world-renowned sports stadium architect.
Designed Paul Brown Stadium, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Okay. Dan Mize, and they unveiled these beautiful renderings on Monday, just 4 days ago, to a small group of season ticket holders. And interestingly, most of the renderings were pictured on the riverfront in Newport.
So it's looking into Cincinnati?
Cincinnati. And so it's like it's one deck, and it's like a very traditional soccer stadium. It's kind of a square, looks a little bit futuristic with a canopy kind of circling all the way around. Interesting that the design is that the end facing the skyline, the Ohio River, the skyline of Cincinnati would be an open area, so that if you're inside the stadium, and the soccer stadium would be going north, south, so you could look out or you could walk out onto this plaza and look over the river and downtown Cincinnati. So that was part of the design for the Newport site. I would assume we didn't see it really placed in the West End site, which is right here, actually right next door here, around Taft High School's football stadium, or in Oakley. So I don't know if there would be this open-ended part of that, but
have they said definitely they're going to put it in Newport?
Oh no, okay. No. They clearly talked about, because they control essentially the Newport site is cleared and ready to go, and they could start today and building a stadium there. There's no hindrances. There's no properties on the site. It's right at the confluence of the Licking and Ohio Rivers. It's a really prime site. Whereas any of the other sites that they've targeted in the West End here, and or I like to call it OTR near, and Oakley, there would have to be some property mitigation or property acquisition. There's about 30 properties they would have to take on the West End site, which could take years to clear the site or to purchase properties and go through buying people's private property. And
that seems like a huge hurdle.
Yeah. And the time frame for them, for this is all about trying to get into Major League Soccer, so the time frame sounds very aggressive, that they have to have a stadium plan in place by the end of the year. And so I'm not sure where the political will or even a lot of the real estate hurdles would be able to be cleared.
What about clearing the funding hurdle? How much would this cost? How would it be funded?
Around $200 million. The club has said they are planning to put in just a little over half of that. What they have said is they are planning to invest $250 million. $150 million of that is actually the entry fee into Major League Soccer. The other $100 would go toward the stadium. There are really few public money options right now. However, Jeff Birding, who is the club's president, former city councilman, worked for the Bengals, did a lot on their stadium, is a really brilliant guy when it comes to these kinds of things. And he has tremendous relationships on both sides of the river, and he gets things done. And I would certainly not underestimate his ability to figure something out. And he is working from a position of power in terms of how just wildly successful the club's been, and the fact that he has lender money behind him and a lot of big, big respected business leaders backing the club.
It does seem like there are many, many fans.
Oh, excuse me.
I was at the game the other night. I mean, it was just I know it's an overused word. It was just awesome. Like 30,000 plus fans, and not to mix personal with professional, but I lost my voice actually for almost a day.
I'm about to lose mine, Jason.
Yeah. It was exciting. It was really, really exciting. A lot of energy, and it's just amazing what these guys have brought to this city.
You know, how might the Bengals stadium deal that was made in the late 1990s, how might that impact FC Cincinnati's plans?
So one of the plans, or one of the ideas that the soccer club has tried to work, is that they could somehow piggyback off of the end of the stadium tax that paying off the debt for the Reds and Bengals stadiums. And the idea generally is that, the stadium tax has no sunset clause. And so in 2032, when the Bengals stadium is scheduled or will be paid off, what's going to happen with that half-cent sales tax that generates around $80 million a year? Well, it's going to happen. It's not scheduled to go back to the ballot. It's not scheduled to just roll off the books. The commissioners of Hamilton County will have to make a decision. And so Jeff Birding, being a smart guy and having been involved in this, has said, hey, what about us? We could maybe grab a little chunk of that and pay off our stadium over, I don't know, 5 to 10 years. And I don't know how that would work in terms of deferring everything until then. That's another, 15 years down the road or so. But that's an idea that's been floated out there. It seems like a non-starter. There's not been a lot of political will to want to, explore that. I guess there's been some the commissioners, I think, are willing to look at it, but there's certainly not any movement that looks like is going to happen there anytime soon.
So we could end up with a soccer stadium right across the river from Paul Brown Stadium and Great American Ballpark. So you'd have this triangle of stadiums sitting there on the river.
Yeah, no, like you look at it from overhead, like a Google map of the site, and it's really a great site. I don't know if there was a smattering of boos. I was not at the event, but I was told by a reporter that there was a handful of people that booed when Newport was mentioned. But it's actually closer to downtown than where the club currently plays at Nippert Stadium. So it's closer to the urban core and all the bars there than where they play now. And it's really a beautiful, I think, a perfect site for them.
Yeah. Any idea what are they trying to shoot for in terms of completing a new stadium?
So they talked about at the event the other night that they would break ground sometime early next year, by, I believe, in the spring. I can't remember exactly. I do know they talked about next year. I do not recall how long they said it would take, but they are targeting to try to get into Major League Soccer by 2020. But that decision, Major League Soccer is expected to be – they're expected to make that decision by sometime around the end of the year, turn of the year. So for bringing an expansion team, or I think they're trying to bring two teams in for 2020. So it's all targeted toward that, to have the stadium done, the team in Major League Soccer by 2020.
Okay. Jason and Ann, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark.
Lisa, you'll stick around for the next segment?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will continue our conversation. You can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon, WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard Kuhn and Ohio Public State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. And Joe, good. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Lisa, thanks for sticking around with us here. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Great to be here.
Joe, the Senate unveiled its version of the Ohio budget this week. So I'm curious to know, how's this differ? What's new in this one?
Well, there's some big differences, actually. One of them is the new budget. It redistributes things differently. For example, one of the things it does is they went through all of these boards and commissions, and they pulled all of the money that they, like a board, they put it underneath the GRF, the General Revenue Fund, versus letting it be a standalone board like it has in the past, and then it would report to the state instead of, to the board. They've got a lot of their money by doing those kind of little shuffling things around. So that's where a lot of the money for this budget that they've proposed has come from. But they made big cuts, $25 million worth of cuts in the Medicaid program and $20 million worth of cuts in the prison system. And so they're dealing with a $1 billion deficit once you figure in that Medicaid spending that's going to be in the equation. And so they're trying to figure out ways to pay for everything, yet, you know, not making drastic cuts. Now, there are 3-4% across-the-board cuts to agencies for the most part, and those were kind of expected. But their tack is very different from the House.
What was they were talking at one point, I think, about an $800 million deficit that they were trying to close, and then it, what, ballooned to a billion?
Right, right. What had happened is there's an $800,000. Let me get my head around this number. There's an $800 million.
It is hard to get your head. It is. It's hard to.
I know. It's such a big number, right?
Yeah.
$800 million thereabout. And that's because of revenue coming in, like tax revenue coming in. But then when they looked at the Medicaid expenditures and the money going out, well, that ballooned to over a billion. So that's what they're trying to deal with, is this huge budget. And, you know, Ohio, you have to have the budget. It has to be in balance. It's not like the feds where you can just let an unbalanced budget slide by. So they have been looking at how can they pull all these things together to make it work. They actually added $6 million to the $170 million that the House had already dedicated for opiate abuse. But what they did is a lot of the little changes that they made, they took local money that was set aside for local purposes, and they have those now going to the state in this budget. And they have the reporting and the, you know, some of the control going to the state instead of going into the local communities like it used to be. So those are some of the biggest changes there.
Yeah, so there's already been a lot of pushback from communities about what was just mentioned, you know, pooling some of this local money. It's money that typically goes into the local government fund. And what's proposed in this budget is taking $35 million from that local government fund that would typically go to cities and putting it to this larger statewide package. And communities are saying, we need that money. We're battling the heroin epidemic, you know, on the front lines. You've already cut millions from our budget by taking from the local government fund in the past. This isn't a way forward.
So at the same time, this is going on. The Democrats have also come up with their own version of a budget, haven't they?
Yes, yes. They've okay. come up with their own version. And the big difference with that one is, you know, over the past few years, Ohioans who have small businesses have been getting tax breaks. And right now, as it stands, small businesses can get can deduct up to $250,000 worth of income free and clear. And that's based on the tax laws, relatively new tax laws in the last few years. And so what has happened is as our revenue's going down, a lot of the Democrats are questioning whether that tax break is the reason that our revenue's going down. Now, you know, Governor Kasich's budget director, he's not ready to say that that's the cause of it. He says, you know, well, the state's getting older and, you know, we're losing, you know, some areas in manufacturing or whatever. And you know, so there's some areas where he can identify a difference. But the Democrats are saying, hey, this is a huge problem. So they pretty much came up with their own budget. And they said, we are going to address this, you know, this tax break, and we're going to suspend it for 2 years in their budget. And then all this money that would have been given out in the tax break, which is about $1 billion, that money they dedicated to, you know, local communities. They dedicated to schools and dedicated to opiates, you know, all of these different areas of government. And they're spending it in different kind of programs. So that's the biggest difference in what they want to do. But, the Senate is run by Republicans up here, and the Republicans have not wanted to embrace any kind of change to the personal or to the business tax cut.
So how many more alterations do you think we have yet to come before we have a final state budget?
Oh, who knows? Who knows? You know, the next week is going to be one of those weeks where we're just, you know, it seems like when they go to pass a budget, there's so much that happens so quickly. And you sit there and you try to figure out, you think one thing's in and this is happening, and then pretty soon something changes. It's very hard to nail down details. So I would not even at this point predict what's going to happen with the budget. And then once the Senate, you know, passes their budget, then you're going to have to get the Senate and the House together, and omnibus, they're going to have to get together and try to figure out how to work out all the details so they come together with one package. So, I mean, there's quite a ways to go, even though they are, you know, they're expected Tuesday to pass some sort of budget.
Wow. And how far, let's see, Governor Kasich put out his proposal, and I'm just wondering, how far removed is all this from what he proposed?
Well, it's, he went back to the gas and oil drilling in his that, you know, the House and the Senate didn't want to have anything to do with that. His budget was different in many ways. So, I mean, they're all three different, and they're going to have to sit down and come up with how they want to hammer this out so that they can come up with one package that Governor Kasich will approve. And we're not a fly on the wall when those kind of discussions are taking place. So
don't you wish you could be?
It's very we'd love to be, but they don't want us in there. So we kind of keep our ear to the ground, hear what we can about what's happening. But largely, these negotiations go on behind closed doors, and who knows what they'll come up with in the next week.
Now, you got a chance to hear from National Republican pollster Frank Lutz this week. I'm curious what he has to say.
Basically, he said the media jumps on these polls way too soon, and that, you know, whatever he says about a poll that's taken today, we shouldn't put too much stock in it. So,
and he's talking primarily about polling for the gubernatorial race,
right?
And also
right.
for the Senate race that's taking place in Ohio. Okay.
Right, right. And he says at this point, you know, he had a focus group. And the focus group, basically, there were a lot of people who voted for Trump in November. And I think he said all but two of them were still, you know, glad they voted for Trump. But he said the big thing is they're watching Trump to see what Trump does. And if he doesn't deliver, you know, then that's going to be a problem. He said that, you know, DeWine looks like he's got a big lead going into the 2018 gubernatorial race, and even could beat Rich Cordray, who is the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington.
But he's not he hasn't declared
he's
yet.
He hasn't declared, but he's been widely talked about as a possibility to jump into the race. And people say, well, he's the one that can, you know, he has the name recognition and he can take on DeWine. But Luntz says, well, not really. He didn't see that in his polling. And then he says that Senator Sherrod Brown has a healthy lead over Republican Treasurer Josh Mandel. And there's another man who jumped in the race, but that's not factored in there. So anyway, that's kind of what he's saying right now. But he's saying, hey, wait, don't put too much stock in this. Don't be, you know, running with it and thinking that this is the way it is, because there's just too much time left.
Exactly. Did he say that Republicans have any reason to be concerned about the midterm election in next year?
Yeah, he actually did. He said the thing is, Republicans need to deliver on their promises. And he said the other thing is that Democrats are raising a lot of money and they're getting momentum right now. And that in combination with Republicans maybe not delivering on their promises or turning people away or turning people off, those two things could really come to play next year. So he's not counting the Democrats out by any means.
Now, Joe, there's an abortion bill that's making its way through the Ohio legislature. Where does that stand at this point?
Okay, well, this abortion bill would outlaw a procedure called dilation and extraction. And it is a procedure that is used in more of the later term abortions, 12 weeks and up. And so what this bill would do is it would outlaw that. It would ban it, and it would say that the only way that that could be used is if the health or life of the mother, it's the life of the mother, not the health, the life of the mother is a concern, then they can use that particular procedure. But and Ohio Right to Life is behind this. They're the biggest anti-abortion group in the state. They support this bill. But as you can imagine, abortion rights advocates are definitely against it. And this week, they staged a protest of sorts. The sponsors of the bill were in the committee, and they were testifying on the bill this week about why it's needed and what this bill would do and so forth. And there's a book out there called The Handmaid's Tale, and there's also
Hulu series. Yeah,
it's a Hulu series. So people know it two different ways, right? And basically the premise of this is that there are handmaids who are young women of childbearing age who lose all their rights in this society. It's American society that, because of some terrorist action, they've reined it in.
And it's dystopian
Yes. Dystopian, it's kind of suspend your belief, kind of a 1984-ish kind of thing.
The original idea came out in the mid-80s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, these women dress, these young childbearing women, they dress in red robes and they have white bonnets that are quite unusually shaped, and they have no say in anything, and they just are basically baby machines. And so the group that doesn't like this bill that's being produced, being introduced right now, they came in. That's the NARALs and the Planned Parenthoods. They had a bunch of their supporters. I think there were 18 of them, and they dressed in these red robes, and they dressed in the bonnets, the white bonnets, and they sat in the first two rows in the committee hearing room when this bill was being introduced. And it was quite a visual scene to see, because you couldn't ignore them. And the sponsors of the bill were having to testify with all these women dressed like that around them. And it attracted some attention.
So what's the status of the bill at this point? It's just in committee right now?
Well, it's been introduced. It'll have more hearings, pro and con. But, what we've got to remember is that, this is a legislature that has widely embraced most of the abortion, legislation that's come before it. They've restricted abortion in many ways in Ohio. And so it's likely that this will have some traction on it.
Well, Joe, thank you for joining us this afternoon. And Lisa, thank you for being here, too, as well.
Great to be here.
Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles, and also WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard Kuhn. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. And Rick Andres was our technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.